Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to episode 688 with my guest, Don Bradley. Very excited to talk about, excited, is that the right word? About PTSD and first responders. It feels like we haven't really touched on that much. We've certainly talked about burnout with people in the helping field, but yeah, really enjoyed this conversation with Don. Just a reminder, if you're new to the podcast, that I am not a therapist and this show is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling, but it is a place for raw honesty. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey. Oh, you know what? Before I do that, I was going down the YouTube rabbit hole. And one of the things that I find to be a guilty pleasure is people who are committing crimes and resist arrest, despite all the facts on the ground being that they will not be able to get away. And there was a video of a woman. She was cornered in her car in a gas station. She had a broken front axle and she's trying to get away. And there's no room to turn in. She can't even turn anyway. She's parked, but her windows are rolled up. And the police take a knife to her tires. And she just keeps trying to drive away. And her tires are flat. And there's nowhere to go. And she's flooring it. And the flat tires are spinning. And there's a part of me that feels rage at her. Like, you're so entitled that you think the laws don't apply to you. And then the more I thought about it, the more I wondered, is she just in some type of survival mode, triggered by something in the past, a fear of the unknown, a personality disorder, somebody whose trust has been consistently violated, who doesn't know what the arrest is going to look like, that it could, you know, being under the control of an authority figure means, you know, your life is in danger. I don't know. I find it so fascinating. And to me, it's different than the person who is resisting arrest and is like, take your hands off me. Don't you know who I am? But I don't know. I find them to be a such a gross, guilty pleasure. I don't know what I get out of that, but this is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself, you can call me Ishmael, and he says, he asked, did you ever meet or work with Mitch Hedberg? I did not, but brilliant comedian, and yeah, really, really sad that he didn't live to continue writing amazing jokes. So many great jokes. Oh my God. The joke about the Dufresne family.
Oh, brilliant.
This is from the Fear Survey. And there's two surveys in a row that I get that thing that we get sometimes with the surveys where it just feels like, I don't know, the universe kind of smiling down and saying, "You, if you're listening, you're not alone," because of the similarities between the two surveys. This one is filled out by a guy, it's from the Fear Survey, filled out by a guy who calls himself Jay, and he writes, "My first two relationships ended with my girlfriend cheating on me. Since these were in high school, I never considered the impact they had on my long-term mental health and issues with commitment. Only after a decade-long relationship ended because I wasn't emotionally available or able to commit did I realize how these previous relationships had impacted me. I hurt the person I loved so much because I wasn't emotionally available or even aware of my emotions, and never mind hers. Only after breaking up and 2 years of therapy did I understand the pain and anguish I caused her. It haunts me every day and causes random bursts of uncontrollable emotions, sometimes to the point where I literally can't function. I don't know how I still have my job. I'm afraid to cause this type of pain to someone else, so have been eschewing relationships and intimacy since. I'm afraid I'll never be able to be with someone again. I'm alone and don't know what to do. I really only see one inevitable outcome." Oh, brother, I really believe that you are capable of intimacy. The fact that you are able to own your part in that, a lot of people go through life never realizing that they are the one who's emotionally unavailable. And they just think, wow, the dating pool blows. I got to move on to the next person. The great thing about being emotionally available is then we get to see how the other person reacts to it. And that gives us all the information we need as to whether or not this is a viable relationship. So put the crystal ball away and get out there, brother. And I think it's awesome that you're in therapy. You really sound like an insightful, sensitive man. And the dating world needs you. This is from the Back in Time survey, and this is the one that I felt like was kind of similar. This is filled out by a guy who calls himself On the Road Again, and he writes, "My best friend from high school and I had a falling out this summer after senior year. There was a betrayal of trust that still impacts me today. It left me depressed to the point where I couldn't get out of bed, and I spent the summer before college as a zombie. For many years, I never really processed that situation or my reaction to it. Looking back, it was the culmination of years of depression, and this falling out only exacerbated the issue. After that, I became a shell of myself and have remained so for about 20 years. It's only after years of therapy that I've begun to comprehend the impact this relationship and what a pivotal moment in my life it was. I wish I could go back and tell myself to get help. It could have prevented decades of pain, isolation, and depression." Pick a positive moment in your day. "My dog is not a furniture dog, but I let her on the bed today to see how she would react. She was so excited and did spinning zoomies. The pure joy she had from this moment made me so happy." Love it. Love it. This is an email that I got from Lucy, and she writes, "Hi, sir. I hope you're having an amazing day." I am. "We are an aluminum carrying case manufacturer. We custom made aluminum case with competitive price, good quality, and cheap, stable transport fee to Europe. Any interested in our offer? ? This is good timing, Lucy, because I have been looking. I have a 2x2, 2 foot by 2 foot aluminum carrying case that I carry my Beanie Babies in. And I've been looking for an aluminum carrying case to store that aluminum carrying case. So I don't know if you make a 3 foot by 3 foot one, but that might sound excessive, but I have two of the rarest Beanie Babies. I have Vanilla Polar Bear and Sherbert Drifter. And I don't know what I would do if something happened to them. I am not in Europe, but I do spend a lot of time at the Vatican. And I don't know if that counts as Europe, but I flew to the Vatican last weekend after I got your email, and I ran this by the Pope. And he said, don't pay to get it delivered, just use my Amazon Prime account. And I said, wouldn't that be dishonest? And then he kicked me in the liver, which I felt honored, but it also really hurt. So I don't know what to do, Lucy. So I think I'm going to go to Monaco, and I don't know if you deliver to Baccarat tables. Is it Baccarat or Baccarat? I'm an idiot. This is from the Fear Survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Learning That I'm Lovable. Share something you fear. I'm afraid that I will die or lose the ability to have an orgasm before I ever have a sexual encounter with anyone. I've been in a mostly sexless relationship with my wife of 23 years, and it's been sexless for at least 10 years. She recently came out to me as asexual, which gave a name to our sexual dysfunction. We've been trying for about 8 years now to come to a compromise regarding sex. She participates on a very infrequent schedule, and I get to actually experience sexual contact. I learned recently that she felt coerced to do so and unsafe to say no, which was devastating to me. I never wanted to hurt her or force her to do anything against her will, and couldn't imagine that it had that effect on her. We're currently in counseling, and I'm hopeful that we can come to an agreement where I can stay married to her and have sexual experiences outside of the marriage. My wife is very much against this at this point, but I guess that's what hope is for. I am open to a divorce as a last possible option because my sexuality is important to me. I've simply lived too long begging for something reasonable that only hurts everyone involved. That is a tough one. That is a tough one. And you're already doing the only thing I can think to suggest, which is to be in counseling and to express your needs. And I think that's a right-sized need, what you want. And I think it's also a right-sized need for your wife to not have sex when she doesn't want to. So it might just be that, yeah, you go your separate ways, but I don't know. I think counseling would be a great place for you guys to hopefully come to some type of decision. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by Beluga Gale. And she doesn't ask anything, but she has a comment. I love the surveys, but sometimes it feels passive-aggressive. When a survey is read, then we can hear you crumpling up the paper and throwing those sensitive, raw words away. Perhaps you consider setting the surveys aside and doing a paper massacre after the recording is stopped. I think that is a great suggestion. And it kind of has floated through my mind in the past that it's disconcerting. And it's not like I feel that somebody listening to their survey being read is like, oh, I'm worthless. He crumpled up my survey. But I do agree that maybe I should just set them aside. Now, I don't know if you've listened so far, but I haven't crumpled. I've been setting them aside. My desk is very crowded, so I had to make a little room. We're going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And then finally, these are some loves from a person who calls himself Tree Hugger Extraordinaire. And they write, I love seeing a heron. As big as they are, they somehow seem like the anti-heroes of the bird empire to me. I love how they stand by the edge of a ditch with hunched shoulders, always looking kind of moody. I love their shaggy gray outfits and the little tuft of feathers sticking out from the back of their heads. They remind me of an old man from the 50s with the smoke in his mouth, complaining that things ain't what they used to be.
That feeling of being trapped in your own life with no way out.
All my altars have different handwriting, different affects.
I'm somebody in prison.
My mom taught me about rape.
And I'm nobody on the streets.
Before she taught me about love.
Nobody will ever love me enough.
There's two lies.
A kind pimp.
Yes. The secret, shameful life at home.
Happiness isn't the goal.
That you always just don't talk about. And then there's the front.
The goal is meaning.
It's hard to go into the dark places.
I should have leaned into that feeling and gotten curious about it.
Recognize when your fears are driving your behaviors.
What you resist gets louder.
And run toward them.
She said, you first. And I said, I might be gay. I was with a girl. And I said, and what do you have to tell me? She said, I'm moving to Florida and this is my last session.
I'm here with Don Bradley. You're a licensed family and marriage therapist. I'm sorry, licensed marriage and family.
Thank you for getting that correct. Yeah. I appreciate that.
And you are a former first responder. You were a police officer for how many years?
For about 10 years, 2 years with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department and about 8 years with the City of Hayward.
And one of the things that you focus on as a therapist is using your expertise to get through to the talking about inner struggles is weakness mentality. The therapeutically challenged. You are based out of the Bay Area. I appreciate you making the trip down here.
Yeah, no problem.
So where do we begin? You know what I'd love to talk about, just to get a little picture of you as a person. What was childhood, kind of the emotional temperature, your ideas of yourself, the world, you know, your emotional kind of literacy as a child, adolescence.
It's deja vu because I feel like I'm asking, these are the questions that, of course, we have to start out with in the therapeutic, you know, ideas, you got to kind of see where you're at, right?
Right.
Born in Oregon for about five, six years.
Where in Oregon?
We were in Hopewell.
Okay.
Just out, but was born in Salem.
Okay.
Right. Product of divorce, you know.
How old were you?
About 5 or 6 years old. And then it was.
So you caused it?
Yes. Totally to blame. And I've been paying requisitely for over the course of my entire life. And of course, you know, as per the rite of passage, I take it out on every person that I know. So, yeah. But product divorce, you know, the kids, mom packs up the kids, says, "Dad thinks we're going on a vacation." Next thing you know, we're not going back, right? And end up in Oklahoma.
Was dad abusive?
I didn't find out that he was abusive with mom, but very emotionally abusive, said he didn't want us. I mean, I heard the whole story afterwards.
With you in the room?
No, he said that. He told that to my sister. He said, they hate each other so much, my mom and dad hate each other so much that we would get in trouble by each person talking to the other person.
Oh, Lord.
You know what I mean? So it was like, and it's which is perspective now, being a therapist, knowing how, you know, couples use their kids as, you know, tools against the other person. It's almost comical how obvious some of it is, but the people in it, they don't get it. And I will be explaining why.
Have you ever met somebody who, as a child or adolescent, was used as a pawn in a relationship that then went on to pick a healthy partner and had intimacy?
Yes.
Well, maybe they wouldn't have come in to see you.
Yes. Have you ever seen anybody win the lottery?
Yeah.
Okay. So the odds are about as good, but usually what happens is that the person finds out the thing that they're in dysfunctional relationships, and then eventually just builds the strength to sort of, you know, step into the thing that they actually want, find the boundaries that they actually want. And that's the whole point of this thing is...
He's got a rubber wristband.
Yeah, this blue rubber wristband that says, can you tell
four
what that
is
says?
Greater than two.
Four is greater than two, right?
The new mission,
a mission being in quotes. Well, there's a lot of symbolism behind that because, I tell every person that I come in contact with, and well, so I got to give you the background still. We got to kind of flash back to the background. So raised in Oklahoma, buckle of the Bible Belt, right? Everybody but us was going to hell.
Did you hate Texans?
We absolutely, so I went to school at the University of Oklahoma. So the answer to that is yes.
Yeah. And just a shout out to Oklahoman, is that the right word? Musicians from Oklahoma.
Of course.
There is a specific flavor to, I don't know if it's because the melting pot of all the influences, but some of my favorite musicians are from Oklahoma. J.J. Cale, John Fulbright.
Look at you, yo.
There's just a laid back, in the pocket, kind of not trying to prove something, but
like
just
a gritty countryness.
Yeah, yeah. And a groove, a realness that I just absolutely love.
There's some real folks out there. That's the part that I, you know, that when I come out here, going back there doesn't seem real because the reality is so different. People like each other out there. They talk to each other out there. They, you know, there's that, the thing, that sort of natural adversarial thing on the West Coast is pretty palpable, especially when you've seen both, right?
And when you talk about the adversarial thing on the West Coast, are you talking about between people on the West Coast and people in the heartland?
Well, it's an individual thing. A lot of this, what I'm going to be talking about is the whole idea of your humanity, right? Everybody has that. It's that thing that everybody is before they're anything else, is to be a human being. And I'm talking about the individual sort of things that we're taught to be an adversary. What are you looking at? You know, why is that person being nice to me? That natural sort of like put up your dukes because the way society is kind of pointing us.
I've mentioned this many times on the podcast, but one of the things that drives me crazy about Los Angeles is when people pass each other on the sidewalk. And I'm not talking about a busy sidewalk. Like when I walk my dog, people avoid eye contact. almost nobody ever says hi to me. I say hi, and it's, I don't know, it's sad.
It's, well, the problem with that I have is you've heard the term, you can't unring a bell, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So doing the whole police thing, I did the anti-terrorism stuff and I learned how to read people's facial expressions and body language. And so when I pay attention to the people in session, I'm paying attention at a pretty deep level. And when you see that walking by on the sidewalk, you're like, oh man, it's like a perishable skill. So being social is a perishable skill and we're starting to go extinct, I think.
So back to you and your child of divorce and...
Oh, and a twin also.
And a twin.
Yeah.
And so what are your first kind of memories as you look back now as a person with emotional intelligence? What are some of the signs you look back on and see that you were perhaps struggling with?
You mean at the time?
At the time, as a child, as an adolescent, maybe even as a young adult.
Well, I think a lot of people can relate to this, is this idea of determining your value from the outside in. And that's basically, you know, if you're in a family situation or society or whatever that feels like it doesn't actually accept you, then you're relying on your eyes to determine whether you're valuable enough. And if somebody can figure that out, then they end up taking advantage of you, right? So it's about being able to have enough courage to kind of stand up and say, actually, I am valuable. I do deserve to find out what this feeling in my gut is. And I do deserve to do something about it. And when somebody's treating me like a doormat, I do deserve to say no and it not be offensive, right? Communication's like playing catch with a baseball. There's the way it's thrown and the way it's caught. If you can realize what game you're playing at any given time, then that thing that hit you in the gut may not necessarily be because the person was trying to do it.
Man, I love that analogy. So what points would you point in your childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, would you say were kind of touchstones for either downward momentum or upward momentum or both?
I can easily say that lack of guidance, lack of parental guidance, you know, having a good, strong father figure, stuff like that, the ones that really teach you how to be a human being, it's not there as much as we want. We want to believe that somebody's showing us how to do it, but they're, you know, how do you say, hey, this is how you say you're sorry. This is how you ask for permission. This is what happened. This is how you react whenever you've really been embarrassed, or when you've done something, when you feel like you've screwed up so much that you're going to be paying it for it for this X amount of time. And the thing I say is we're the inmates and the wardens in our own jail. And it's like, whatever thing it is you do, whatever mistake it is that you make, once you decide that, you can go, am I allowed to let myself out? Not how long is it? Mm-hmm. Whose eyes are going to come through? Am I allowed to let myself out? Yes. Okay. When that day comes, allow yourself to be out of jail.
The fine line between self-reflection and negative self-obsession, I think, is one of the greatest challenges in life. To know when to say, okay, note to self, I'm going to try to do better next time, but I'm a human being and I deserve love and everybody is fallible, rather than, oh, that stupid thing I said at that party in October of 1998, I am a terrible person.
Sure, sure. Well, do you have a crystal ball?
Mine is so broken.
Okay. Do you have a time machine?
Not yet.
Okay. Can you read minds?
A little bit.
Okay, so if you don't have a crystal ball, that means you can't look into the future and be right. Your brain will worry about a million different things that aren't going to happen, and then you get there and go, it's always the same. Why do I worry like that? If you don't have a time machine, then if the only thing you're going back to get that information or to think about that thing, either the lesson or the punishment, or not both, but if you're going back there to kick yourself in the ass, we'd have evolved a leg in our back if God wanted us to kick ourselves in the ass. Sorry, I use a lot of analogy and metaphor.
Dude, I love them. If, my addiction is, I'm not addicted to drugs and alcohol. I should say I don't go to those anymore, but God, do I become addicted to analogies, because I so want to be able to express any kind of progress that I've made as a person in a way that it can help other people. And I think analogies and stories are
the whole reason I'm here. I've battled with a sense of imposter syndrome through this whole thing, because who the hell am I, right? I'm a nobody for that. If it were up to me, I would Men in Black you, and I'd say, just remember the message. That's all this is about. It's not about the message, not the messenger, right? And so when I think about this, I'm like, who the hell am I to be doing this? And then when I talk with somebody, and so you have to understand that I'm a little bit more no-nonsense because of the whole anti-terrorism thing. I tell people, you know, you can lie all you want, you're just not doing it to me. And so it's this sense of, it's this acknowledgement that we hold up masks all day, every day. We also hold them up for ourselves, and you don't have to do it here, right? So when I give them that whole spiel, it's kind of like, hey, let's cut the bullshit. We're in here to get from A to B. And because not only is that I notice that being trying to very begrudgingly become a patient through the process, right? Starting out in Oklahoma, men don't cry, rub some dirt on it, you little pussy. You know, like that type of stuff. Society says that men weren't allowed to do that. So you just take that stuff and you just shove it down into that container, right?
Yeah.
Well, if that's our mechanism and we just drill that down there so deep, we can't expect it to be there all of a sudden when the thing explodes, all of a sudden be like, it's like a muscle. If you just say, no, you can't put any weight on that muscle, but you better be there whenever I put the entire weight of the world on it. It's like, well, no wonder it doesn't work.
Yeah. What are some moments, we were talking about self-forgiveness. What are some moments that you look back on as a first responder where you had to practice self-forgiveness, even though there was a part of you that's like, God, I wish I would have handled that differently?
Well, oh boy, self-forgiveness. Talk about an ongoing process, right? It's one of those things. It's how water made the Grand Canyon, right? You're slowly trying to forgive yourself so that you can slowly forgive all the people that you resent and all that kind of stuff, right? But having gone through sort of what I went through and some of the stuff that I saw, terrible stuff, and some of the things that I continue to hear this day because I talk with the people that will only talk to me, right? They're
first,
like
first just responders,
to, yeah,
in
just
therapy.
To get it, just to get in the door with the first responder community. They're like, I need to know that you're not going to be the patches on the sleeves person, right? And so it's battling with that sense of imposter syndrome, but realizing that I have to be the one to tell them, hey, this is who I am, and this is why this message is important. Because I've been delivering this message, and you've seen the face melting scene from Indiana Jones, right? Mm-hmm. There's some, battle hardened people, men and women who have come in and listened to this and went, shit, I never thought about it like that. And it was like, it's that sense of, in fact, I have to build in a rebound effect. I say, you're going to talk to me. We're going to talk about this stuff. We're going to, dive into it. And when we do, here's what's going to happen. You've had this system in there that basically tells you you're not allowed to feel this stuff. And especially as a first responder, whatever you got taught in society before is made worse by the fact that going into a situation like that, where you're seeing a dead child or a horrific murder or a car crash or something like that, you need to see that, feelings are the color in the painting. You don't want to see any color in that painting. Right. And so you basically just got to turn it all the way off. Well, unfortunately, you get really good at it and it starts seeping out into everything else. You're learning how to not have an emotional capacity.
And in what ways were you doing that? If you I love a good story.
Oh boy.
Any vignettes?
Oh boy. Well, so mother died of cancer in front of me. In 2004.
Your mother?
My mother, yes. And so here's the story. I get the call saying she's been battling cancer for years, started out with one and ended up getting all of them and died of brain cancer. But So I get that call and I drive from Northern California all the way out to Oklahoma. And I get there, I'm there less than 12 hours. And I'm sitting there and in this story, the house is obviously a lot smaller than when I was there last, you know, in the grand can't go home again type of way. And it's filthy and it's the walls are covered with smoke. You know what I mean? Because of how much she chain smoked during chemotherapy. Right. So it's like you're not halting that process. And so she's going through that. And by the time I get there, she's can't speak. Can't even tell if she acknowledged that I was there, but I was sort of the first one there. No, my sister got there first, but I got there and I was sitting there the next day and I'm sitting in my room. She is in my room. This is the room that used to have, 80s posters and Star Wars models and this kind of stuff. And now it's completely tan, used to be white. Pictures off the wall and you can see the mm-hmm. nicotine rings, a picture of my mom at her peak and the picture of my mom at her lowest. Right. You know what I mean? Right.
It's like,
now mind you, I'd been a police officer for a couple of years, seen some pretty horrible things, a lady get eaten by her dog. And yet that's not who's sitting there watching that lady. It's not a cop watching this and the thing, it's the kid who owned that room last, right? And sitting there watching her, and then all of a sudden I'm kind of not really thinking about it, but I do remember it being like a really nice day that I could only see through a small hole, right? Which is, symbolic very much. And then I looked at her and I could tell she was dying. She started heaving a little bit and some stuff came out of her mouth and I'm in shock and I just kind of stand up and I walk in and I get my stepfather and first time I've ever seen that guy cry, he's bawling his eyes out. My sister comes in and climbs up in the bed with her and is wailing at the top of her lungs and I'm just sitting there, right? Because I'm not allowed, right? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, I went through that and I really, really, really struggled with that because I'm like, shit, now what do I do? My best friend just left, right? What am I supposed to do? Who am I supposed to ask now? And it was that. Now, granted, she was busted, right? I don't realize how sort of emotionally busted she was, but she didn't do it to us. You know what I mean? Right. So I'm grateful in as much as she had every right to fuck us up, and she didn't, right? But was she messed up? Yeah, I realize that now, emotionally distant and all that kind of stuff. And then of course dad was, just an ass. So after that funeral, I take a couple flowers from the casket. I decide that I'm going to basically drop them in each state as I come back. Right. I'm trying to figure it out. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing as far as grieving goes. Right. I don't think I'd ever experienced anything other than, seeing the occasional exploded body, that's a whole different thing, right? Mm-hmm. Different party category of, but that was like, oh fuck. Right. She's supposed to be there forever. Right. Just like, and I know people struggle with that all the time. And they really don't want to admit it. It's like, well, yeah, when you saw them and they reached this time in your mind where they're 10 feet tall, then when they're laying in a bed, all you're remembering is how sad it is that they're not 10 feet tall anymore. Right. Make sense?
Makes total sense.
So anyway, so we get the 20th anniversary is coming up actually next month. And so we do the funeral. It was nothing I don't recall there being like this, big explosion of a moment. But I start taking these flowers back and I get started a little late on the first day. I'm in Texas, in the panhandle of Texas, and it's dark. I just got done eating and I'm like, I got to pull over. Crap, I totally forgot about this. Pull off in the middle of nowhere, turn off the lights. It blew my mind. It absolutely blew my mind. I could not believe what I was seeing. From horizon to horizon, in every direction, was just a canopy of stars. Like, absolutely, and it was exactly what I needed. Because I looked up there, and I'm like, I realized that you will find that I'm not a scientist, and this is not a scientific statement. However, every speck of light up in that sky is a sun somewhere else, right? With the idea being that there's another Earth out there somewhere else, and there's other people out there who've had their mom die in front of them, so I don't have to be alone, right? And it's like, and that was tough because I was like, wait a minute, we lean in this direction, right? If we don't lean in this direction, if this person disappears, what happens to me, right? And so I took that information for the longest time and absolutely was tortured by it, because I sat there and watched. I sat right there in front and watched my mom die. And then my sister, the one who crawled up in the bed with her, and she told me one time, I was, you know, really grateful for her to kind of put it in this way. She said that if you believe in God, and I do, then if you believe in God, then you know that she needed you to be there. He orchestrated this thing so that you could help her through this scary time. And we were best friends, right? And so spinning it that way, because I could either make it the worst day of my life or the biggest honor of my life, right?
I've heard many people say that, especially in recovery. They say, I got to be there when my dad passed. I got to do this or that. And it's, to me, such a profound mind shift between had to get to.
Well, you also have to consider too that sometimes people really struggle, like my twin brother, he wasn't there when she died, right? I was the one that had to let everybody else know, and I was like, why me? Why do I have to be the one to do this? And then that was another part that, because I deal a lot with grief and stuff like that too. And a lot of people, I realize you have to realize that person may very well have tried very hard to make sure that's not the last image that you have of somebody. Mm-hmm. Right. It's like, because if you've ever seen the big strapping dad who's now, you know, down in hospice and that type of thing, I think that the big strapping dad would be like, hey, do you want your kids to see you in this last moment? They'd go, of course not. I want you to remember me whenever you were smiling and all that kind of stuff, right? And it's tough, because that's a tough thing to put these kids through.
I still have guilt that I wasn't there when my dad died. And if I'm going to be totally honest, I was afraid to be there.
What were you afraid of?
Maybe the unknown, maybe emotions. And I've been sober for about 3 years. He died in 06. And I did get to see him about 3 months into it being terminally diagnosed. He died after about 6 months of being terminally diagnosed, and he was back in Chicago. And I don't know. I think I was afraid of seeing death.
Well, it's not just death. It's your dad's death, right? And all the symbolism, everything that symbolizes, right? That's a road where you go, because when we originally set these things up in our heads, we think they're going to last forever. We think our container's always going to be empty. And I'm here to tell you that when we're given that container, whether we get good parents, bad parents, no parents, love and support, abuse and neglect, it dictates how big that container is and how quickly that inevitable bill will become due. That's the part that first responders as a whole don't understand, is that bill is going to come due. And whether you pay it now or over time, it's one of those emotional bills that will come due.
So let's then fast forward to you transitioning to a therapist. Let's even jump into your work with other first responders and maybe begin with how you connect.
Well, obviously, so as a first responder, the thing that that You don't know what you don't know as far as how it's going to change your life and how it's going to, how you're going to have to sort of adjust in relationships. And of course, that was a very difficult adjustment. There was a lot of, you know, cliche type of things happening from lack of communication. And so we ended up having to go to therapy. And this is embarrassing considering that my background's in psychology and she is in fact a therapist,
right?
So the want to stay away from that process because we're better than everybody else, right? We should already have this down was, you know, sort of palpable. But then add on top of that, a industry where you're told you can't feel the feelings and your whole entire life that men aren't supposed to do this and all this kind of stuff. It just gets drilled into you so deeply. It's like, once you try to pull it out, it's like trying to pull out a hook, you know, and so it doesn't come out that way. Right.
What inspired the transition from, police work to therapy? Was it, what did that transition look like?
Well, when I was in Oklahoma, everybody told me that they thought that I talked well and that I could connect. I always seemed to be connecting. I was an old soul, right? I always talked to the adults and stuff like that. And I kind of got that now. And as I went through, I didn't really, like I said, you don't get that mentorship. I was like, well, what do people do when they do that? Well, psychology, of course, and go into psychology to start doing it in school. And I'm like, well, shit, I don't want to sit and listen to people's problems all day. It was like, no, I want to get out there and help people, right? I wanted to be able to apply that. And once I said, I don't want to do that, I went through this terrible time in school, rough time transitioning out to California as far as just trying to find a job and knowing what I'm doing. And then all of a sudden one day I'm like, I don't want to die in a cubicle. If I'm going to die, I want it to be doing something heroic. Right. And I'm sure there's a bunch of first responders going to relate to that. And I just want to help people. Right. That seems to be the basic theme. I hear the stories all the time, but the basic theme comes down to either somebody in my family was one. And so that's what I'm going to do, or some incident, good or bad, happened. And I either want to emulate it or correct it. Right. It's that
physician
typical,
heal thyself.
It is totally that template. Right. And that's not, I wouldn't be revealing anything specific because it's such a template. Right. And so once I started to realize that, I'm like, yeah, I want to be in the fire department. And I went, I don't think my, at the time it was through the 90s, my demographic, I was outside of my demographic. How about we just blob it into that category, right? And so I ended up going into the sheriff's department, went through the corrections, did that for about 2 years, saw some terrible things in there. And
where were you?
In North County Jail in Oakland before they, in the Santa Rita mix over there. And then transferred out onto the street in Hayward. And started once after 9/11, I was like, I want to try to be the guy on the street that catches them. Right. And that idealistic pie in the sky type stuff. Right. But that's how it starts. Right. And then, so I did all the anti-terrorism stuff, learn the body language and doing the crime scene technician. I want to be able to analyze the scene and all that kind of stuff. And it was awesome. But I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Somebody didn't sit there and go, hey, here's how being a police officer is going to change your life, especially as somebody who has the understanding of psychology, meaning like, I know it's there. I know it's valid. My whole scholastic career is based on it up to that point. So it's not, it doesn't fall into the same category as all the other guys who just go, just suck it up. Right. And so that door was cracked open. And when I started going through this and seeing this stuff, and I'm like, where in our brains is this stuff supposed to go? Where do you put the people without their heads? Where do you know what I mean? And right. So there's got to be a spot for that stuff. And it's got to be in the least caustic spot possible, right? If you keep a vat of acid in your stomach, eventually it's going to eat through you, right? The idea is don't keep it there.
Right.
And so you gotta acknowledge, hey, that thing you saw, that was really fucked up. That thing you saw was really scary. That time you thought you were going to die, it's okay to be scared, because when you think you're going to die, that's what you're supposed to do. You know what I mean?
And how were you coping with
drinking?
Yeah.
I was drinking. It was, I ended up getting into a little domestic violence. You want that little vignette's pretty interesting.
And when you say domestic violence, what do you mean?
Domestic violence, restraining order call.
I got you.
Right. My partner and I get called to the place, right? The call comes out as, the lady says that her husband is there. She got a restraining order against him, and that's just, you know, paper in hand is automatic, right? State of California's got some work to do on its justice system. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But we get there, of course, what comes out and versus what happens when we're there is completely different, right? We make contact with the lady at the front. She asks her what happened. She says, my husband and I have been smoking crack all day. We got into an argument, and now I want him gone. And then she holds up the paper. So we arrest her. Get the key to the house. Oh, yeah.
Why arrest her?
Well, in addition to obviously looking like she was under the influence, she admitted to being like, it was almost like, I know I'm not the one in the wrong, but we were smoking crack all day. And now I have this piece of paper that says it was as dumb as it sounds.
Right. And did you arrest him as well?
Well, so we're getting to that. That's okay. The next part of this, right?
Okay.
So she gives us the key to the house. House is all blacked out. It's just me and my partner. We go in. We go to clear the house. And he's locked himself in one of those back half bathrooms, you know, where you can use the sardine can opener thing mm-hmm. to get in there, right? Knock on the door. Police. Who is it? We tell him it's the police. And we're like, I need you to come out. And he goes, you're going to arrest me? And he said, yeah, we're going to arrest you. He goes, then I'm not coming out. No, okay. I didn't mind. I liked the scuffle. You like the scuffles until that last one, right? And then you're like, I don't like these anymore. Or until it becomes a fight for your life. Then you're like, okay, that's kind of stupid. But we got into this scuffle. So I ended up pointing my taser at him as I opened the door. And he's in there just puffing away on his click, click, click. And just puffing away and just smoking crack. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I'm like, are you kidding me? Is this, am I being recorded right now? And so, I point the taser at him. He just said, come in, come out. And he starts walking towards me, but it's too small. There's no way he's getting past me. Right. Like, right. It's not like he can, you know, step to the side and no, it's a small doorway and I'm even bigger than I am now. And so as soon as he doesn't comply, I shoot the taser. Taser doesn't work. Go in after him to wrestle him down. Wrestle him down. The door slams behind he and I inside the bathroom. We're fighting. He doesn't feel me even there because he's high as a kite, right? Finally, I go, I got to do something. This guy's because he's wearing me out, right? And because he's high on meth. So, I get out my flashlight because the baton won't stretch out. It's one of those expandable batons, and I hit him as hard as I can across the shin, breaks his shin, but also breaks my arm and the humerus bulb right here at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so it popped off the humerus bulb here and then cut up a bunch of nerves. And that's what that's a two surgeries.
That's a nasty looking scar.
Yeah. But anyway, so go start trying to get that fixed. Go through a terrible, terrible workman's comp process. And if any first responder listens to this, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about when it comes to workman's comp. Terrible process. Got addicted to basically pain pills. And some of the stuff I was taking was making me suicidal. And that's really easy to do, especially if you're not telling anybody. And then, of course, being on one of my friends put this in a great way is that you're on the front line. And when you get injured, you're not on the front line anymore. And it's not that these guys don't care about you, is they don't know how to care to somebody who's not on the front line anymore. It's just because you're going, me coming off this front line, turning this thing on that I've told I'm not allowed to turn on to apply it to you. That doesn't happen. It's just a capacity that you know, it's like, hey, I need your help being a friend with emotions. Everybody like, go talk to your sister. You know, it's that yeah. type of way, right? Because the thing that people don't understand, and this is, I'm going to sort of segue into my spiel here a little bit. I tell this stuff that I'm telling you is super simple. It's embarrassingly simple. And that's the thing is that's why I feel like such an imposter. Cause I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. This stuff is the things I'm about to tell you, Sesame Street would turn down because it's not complicated enough. Right. And so the idea that that needs to happen, there's a reason that needs to happen. Number one, because that's the place that I came from. All right. I'm as chest thumping a caveman as any person out there. Right. But what happens is we forget this thing. And I want to remind us why we forget it in the simplest way possible, because when we need it, it needs to be simple. It's gotta be like stripped down all the way down, yes or no type of simple. Okay. So if this right here, this is the sign language thing for M, mm-hmm. right? If
he's
this is
up the closed fist.
Right. If this is your brain, then the Fonzie thumb right here, that's the very source of your survival. Fight, flight, faint, or freeze. Okay. That's the thing that little peanut that grows up in your brain is responsible for fight, flight, faint, or freeze. When you're born, all you want to do is breathe in, breathe out. Eat when you're hungry, drink when you're thirsty, run when you're scared, like that type of stuff, right? And then you get influenced by the people in your life, like I said, good parents, bad parents, no parents, love and support, abuse and neglect dictates the size of this container. And then we get our higher functions, logic and reasoning, the rest of the brain comes in. But why do the military guys, why do the fire guys, why do the police and fire personnel, why do they train over and over and over and over and over again? Because when the shit goes down, the only thing that's on is this part of our brain, the fight, flight, faint, or freeze. All of the rest, the high functioning, the logic, the reasoning, it all turns off. If you've ever gotten really mad, done something really stupid, or drank or whatever, and then went back and went, God, what did I do that for? That's this portion of your brain, the logic and reasoning, casting judgment on the survival brain for doing the only thing it knows how to do, and that's survive. It's react. This doesn't have eyeballs. It doesn't have ears. It hears somebody, sees something, it says something, and next thing you know, it's click, right? That's why we can still go into survival mode when we think about something we have to do tomorrow, right? Because it doesn't have eyeballs. It doesn't have ears. It just says, oh, end of the world tomorrow? Oh, okay. Let me start worrying about it now, right? Well, jump in your time machine and see if that's true, right? The idea is you're trying to remind yourself of your basic humanity, right? That thing to go, because the only thing that you're doing when this part of your brain is on, that survival instinct, is to turn it off. It's not to negotiate the rest of your life, or it's not to work out the rest of your relationship or make sure you figure it out before you leave. No, it's basically going, I need to de-ass the area. And so I can bring my heart rate back down to the person I want to be, to the heart rate of the person I want to be, not the heart rate of somebody who wants to strangle you. Right? Does it make sense?
It does.
Well, so one of the main things that I wanted to with that sort of imagery inside your head is to tell you about this new mission, right? There's three things that have to happen in order for change to occur. I get sweaty, embarrassed when I think about how obvious these things are. But when I tell you about them, you're going to be like, okay, they're not that obvious. I'm imploring everybody that hears this to understand they're not that obvious. Number one, you have to acknowledge that something's going on. If you've been depressed for 20 years, you've been depressed for 20 years. It's not who you are.
He's using air quotes.
Who yes. You are. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Number two, you have to actually accept the level to which that thing is negatively affecting your life for real, right? Quote unquote, I only drink a little bit. Yeah. Everybody else thinks you're an alcoholic, but until it changes in you, it ain't going to change, right?
Right.
Third and most important, and that is the new mission, is that you have to give yourself permission to act on your own behalf. How do you tell somebody whose whole goal is be a man, don't ever do this? At some point, that person has, I'm saying, hey, there's a bill that's coming due. How do you deal with it now so that you don't have to do it all at the end, right? This idea of, and so I try to paint out this analogy of, have you ever been to the county fair, like a, like any type of county fair?
Sure.
What do you think of when you go to a county fair?
I think of, really sweet food.
Good. Imagery, any type, like, you know, funnel cakes, corn dogs, Ferris wheels, the smell of hay, stuff like that. Do you remember those water guns where the horses are racing each other? Okay. So imagine every person on the planet. Now, mind you, like I said, this is the thing you are before you're anything else. Before you're a man, you're a woman, before you live in a particular part of the country or whatever, the first thing you are is a human being, right? Mm-hmm. You get these body systems, and I'm here to tell you this, it's why it's embarrassingly simple, is I'm trying to remind you of your body systems every time you feel, have that feeling in your gut, right? And I'll tell you why, right? Right. This is this we'll call the fight, flight, fight, or freeze we talked about before. This is the little brain. The rest of the logic and the reasoning is the big brain. Okay. Well, so we're going to refer it to it like that. Well, every person on the planet has those four horses, has that same system, right? Four horses pulls your team. Four horses pulls my team. Okay. There's the physical horse. That's the, that your physical presence, right? If you're Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or you're a tiny person, if you're big, if you're gym in the gym all the time, if you're sick all the time, it's your physical identity. Okay. But you fall on a spectrum. Pope, president, everybody falls on a spectrum. Okay. Then there's the intellectual horse, book smart, street smart. Okay. Somewhere in between. Then there's a social horse. Okay. Now, mind you, I'm going to speak from the chest thumping Neanderthal perspective because that's the place I came from. Right. Then there's the social horse, right? Loner versus the cool kid in the group. Mm-hmm. And then there's the emotional horse. Okay. We'll get back to this one, the emotional horse. Bang, the gun goes off. Those four horses go try to find your identity, right? We find it physically. We find it intellectually. We find it socially. But we don't find it emotionally because nobody wants to be the emotional person, right? Especially if you're, you know, if you're not allowed to feel feelings or whatever, then you're told your whole entire life, that horse has to go back to the gate. We're going to lock that thing down. When things get difficult, you figure it out. Physically, what do? I work overtime. I fight. I go to the gym. What do I do intellectually? How many guys, you know, can solve everybody else's problems but their own, right? Because it's an intellectual process dealing with an emotional issue, right? Socially, what do? We go out, we hang out with our friends, we talk about the terrible things that happened to us and give us the excuse to loosen it up a little bit. Sometimes the only acceptable therapy that some people can do, right? Mm-hmm. But that last horse, that emotional horse, it's not allowed to leave. So we think that container is going to be there forever, but look what happens. We stack up every emotional thing, every picture that required color is stacked up in the path of that emotional horse, just waiting. And it just, the thing gets bigger and bigger and the stack gets bigger and bigger pretty soon, right? It may be something big, maybe it's something small or whatever, but that gate cracks open. Now, mind you, those first three, they're thoroughbreds, right? They're jacked. They've got you figured out. They know who you are. When things get difficult, you know, they've got your coping mechanisms down, but then all of a sudden something happens, right? Trauma from way back when, constant shit, basically drinking yourself to death and, you know, taking pills and stuff like that just keeps on stacking up because we're ignoring the stuff that's that for that horse, right? And then all of a sudden that little baby comes out. You ever seen a baby horse being born, right? It walks on stilts. It doesn't have the ability to carry for its weight, right? It's carrying, it's basically just trying to get up on it. And then it comes out and looks at that Mount Everest pile of shit and goes, oh, screw that. Screw that. I can't even hold myself up. And you want me to deal with something with the three bullies in my ear telling me, just get back in the gate. We got this, right? They're bullies, right? And so you got to give that little guy permission. Hey, guess what? You're going to be scared. Guess what? Back when you were a kid, you got scared and you didn't want to admit it. Now you're angry and take it out on everybody else, right? That shit goes in somewhere else and comes out the open door. And I'm telling you, that's the mission. I use the tactical language, right? I want them to join my mission. This mission is, you know, saving people's lives. And I want them to, you know, to draw them in to say, hey, that's the new mission. Come join the new mission. And basically what it is you got to give yourself permission to let that little guy out and say, this is too much for me, right? But have you ever seen anybody jump to the top of Mount Everest?
I saw one guy. He had sandals on, and he
leapt with impressive. All of his. Yes,
it was impressive.
Right, yeah. Small steps and a guide. Right, if somebody's gone there before you, right, then that's why I got to say, hey, you know what? I used to be a cop. I did all this stuff. I know how to tell when people are lying. You don't have to lie. Do you hold up these masks? You don't have to hold up these masks anymore. I know that when you get frustrated that we use these frustrations as means with which to try to protect ourselves from that fear we don't want to feel, right? And so it gets kind of tough, and that's why I put the word list on the other side of that bracelet, on the other side of the bracelet I gave you. It's got, you know, if you don't have a crystal ball, right, then how could you have done something different? What should you have done? How should you be feeling, right? Based on what? What's your metric? And it's that little brained person inside of us feeling the emotions of this container that's too full, going, I'm a terrible person.
And coulda, like, shoulda, woulda, never, always, such, those are words that do not help.
Well, I wish I would have done this or that. And it's like, okay, my stepfather, God bless that man, is, he said, wish in one hand, shit in the other one, seeing which one gets filled first. And I was, and you don't realize the, you know, the Whitman-esque poignancy of that statement until you realize, yeah, you're right. If wishing is not doing anything, it's basically, you're just trying to make sure you're starting in the right place. That's why this isn't therapeutic. It's more motivational. It's like, hey, if you don't ever give yourself permission to start, then you can't be surprised when you feel like shit, or you can't be surprised if that little guy hasn't, the little horse hadn't come out, and you haven't, if you're feeling suicidal, it makes sense because that guy said, nope, I can't do it. And then I'm just going to take my life. And frankly, that's why I'm here. This is why I would never have come and done something like this if I wasn't just tired of seeing guys and the guys and gals out there take their own lives. It's not fair.
And it's an epidemic.
It is. It's bad, and it's getting worse. And I'm hearing stories that are disturbing in that it's, I that's why I want to simplify this, because if there's somebody sitting out there in their patrol car, and these are somebody who's sitting in their patrol car doing duty, wanting to end their life in their hand and have the ability to do so, that's a big deal, obviously, right? And if that's the one person who tells you, right? Mm-hmm. There's other people out there that are doing unbelievably terrible things to themselves, right? And ultimately, that whole four is greater than two thing is designed as a sort of mantra to remind the people. So if you imagine you're the most cantankerous anti-therapy person known to mankind, right? You're going to come in there and say that therapy is a bunch of bullshit. Fine. Good. I hope you think that's true, because here's the deal. At some point, I'm telling you that bill is going to come due. And I'm here. And what I'm trying to tell you is, if you treat that thing like a muscle and say, hey, you can't just say muscle don't work and then at the end go, okay, muscle, now you can. It's like, no. Right. The thing I'm trying to address is this idea that it's weakness, right? Because and when I liken it to the whole muscle analogy, you've seen the world's strongest man competition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Largest human beings in the world picking up world records amounts of weight for world records amounts of time. When they finally put that weight down, does it mean that they're weak, or does it just mean it was time to put it down, right? That muscle you're using, that thing you're trying out, it's going to feel awkward when you pick it up for the first time. It's going to feel sore after you've, you know, talked about stuff from your past, and it's, you're going to feel weak because the other three parts of your identity that are already an adult, quote unquote adult, are going to go, I can't believe you're doing this. You should be so ashamed for letting this stuff out, that you look so, you know, weak when you do it. And that is the biggest bunch of bullshit I've ever heard in my life, especially when you realize that it is in fact the color in the painting. But when you understand that professional people who go and see these terrible things, you can't really be surprised when they turn the color off, because those are paintings out there that they don't want to see the color in that.
And the thing that I think is also really important for people recovering is to understand that it gets the trauma, the things we don't want to think about, they get buried in layers and they get removed in layers. And it is so important to have patience with the process. It's not linear. It's circuitous. It's two steps forward, one step back. And that doesn't mean it's not working.
One step up and two steps down. You have to, that's the one thing that, telling you about giving yourself permission is that you are going to fall down. Falling down is part of the process, but so is getting up. And that's the idea, is detaching it from this idea that when you fall down, it's not working. No, you're falling forward. You're falling up. You're picking yourself up in a direction that's going towards the top of the mountain. You're just taking smaller steps.
Yes. Yeah. Not quitting is a baby step.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, Don, thank you. Thank you so much. Where can people find you? You're based out of the Bay Area. The
less bougie Brentwood up in Northern California is where I hang my far too big hat, in the East Bay area, out near Stockton, the Brentwood Discovery Bay area.
And is there a website?
Well, let's see. You can go to Psychology Today and look for Don with two N's, Don Bradley, if somebody wants to talk to me, especially first responders. But I will talk to any human beings. Like I said, that's what we are before we're anything else. And you got to start with your permission. So.
Well, Don, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Kudos on the work you're doing.
Much obliged.
Hope you enjoyed that. I enjoyed that. And we'll put a link to, there's just one link that that Don has, and it's to his profile as a therapist. So if you're in the area that he lives, I don't know if he does online, if you said that. Yeah, there you go. We're going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is from the Shouldn't Feel This Way survey, and this is filled out by what gender is this person? A guy who calls himself thank everything holy for vasectomies. How would you like people to think of you? As a kind and generous person. How does it feel writing that? I got them all fooled. How would you use a time machine? Go back and kill a bunch of bad relationships before they left the scars. Please write as many of these as you feel like. I'm supposed to feel blank about blank, but I don't. I'm supposed to feel unconditional love for my 5-year-old niece, but I don't. I feel like that kid needs a little bit of trauma, pain, and fear in her life. How does it make you feel writing your real feelings out? Sad. She deserves better. And would be better off if I stay out of her life. Do you think you're abnormal for feeling what you do? Yes, stunted, like I never developed normal adult emotions and still fall back on how I was treated, neglected, and abused as a child. Would knowing other people feel the same way make you feel better about yourself? Thinking about pushing a child off a cliff into the ocean shouldn't make people feel better. ... Children are awful. That was a really refreshingly honest survey. Does that sound like I'm spinning it? Maybe it does. But I think it's so important for us to really be honest about what it is that we're feeling. And that's how you feel about kids. It's great you haven't had kids. It's great that that person is your niece. And not your daughter. And I don't think there's anything wrong with disliking children. I think it's good that you know that. I don't dislike children, but I find them extremely draining after 5 minutes. Does that count? But thank you for your survey. This is from the Shouldn't Feel This Way survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Comfortably Numb. How would you like people to think of you? As a sexy, powerful, smart, and kind woman who made a powerful impact on the world. How does it feel writing that? Like it's only a fantasy and will never happen. How would you use a time machine? To go back to when I was 10, and my 11-year-old sister was about to play a stupid game that would almost kill her and destroy all our lives forever, and I'd tell her not to do it. I would stop her. I'm not sure exactly what that means. It sounds like she got hurt. I'm supposed to feel happy about being married, but I don't. I feel trapped. I'm supposed to feel friendly about my best friend, but I don't. I feel sexual desire for him. How does it make you feel writing your real feelings out? Like I am a piece of shit. Do you think you're abnormal for feeling what you do? No. Would knowing other people feel the same way make you feel better about yourself? No. You know, assigning morality to our feelings is one of the most counterproductive things we can do in our lives. You know, I say it all the time, there are no good or bad feelings. There's comfortable and uncomfortable feelings, but there's no morality to what we feel. There's just a morality to what we do with it. There's sometimes not even morality, just good or bad tools for how to deal with it. This is from the Happy Moments survey filled out by, I believe we've read some of her surveys before. She calls herself Menti B. Queen. And share a happy moment. She writes, a few days ago, my daughter was inducted into the National Beta Club. She works very hard in school and is a wonderful student and a fucking amazing person. During her ceremony, I was overwhelmed with happiness and so damn proud of her, I struggled to hold back tears. The way her face lit up when she scanned the room and saw me, her little sister, and her dad, all there to support and honor her, made me smile nonstop the rest of the day. It made me feel as if I'm doing an okay job as a parent. It made me feel she truly loves her family and feels the pride we have in her. It simply made me so happy. There was not a single negative thought in my mind. Love it. Love it. Thank you for that. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey filled out by Comfortably Broken. I wonder if this is the Comfortably Numb woman. Sneaking in another survey under a different name. No, actually, I fill out as many surveys as you can. That gives me more to choose from. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? I am weak and not powerful enough to change my dad from an abusive, broken man into the good and wonderful person he is deep inside. I tell myself that if only I was more powerful and did not let his terrible behavior hurt me, that I can push past his darkness that he so desperately clings to and turn it into life. I tell myself that people only love me if I am saving them from themselves or doing something for them. I tell myself that secretly I'm a love addict who is constantly looking for a strong, good man who can protect me from my father, but at the same time, I fear strong men. So I chose a husband who is more feminine, but that makes me not want to desire him, and instead, I am the man in the relationship. I tell myself that I know all of this, and I chose it, and therefore, I must be happy. Thank you for that, and what a great example of how the ripples, the complicated ripples from our issues can be, especially when it goes back to childhood shit and a caregiver. And I really hope that you have found some type of support network for codependency, whatever it is that you want to call it, or processing the stuff around your dad to get clarity on what you can control and what you can't. And the things we can control, there's not many. Mostly it's just our reaction to shit. This is an email that I got from David Nick, and he writes, "Did you authorize Mrs. Linda Chambers to claim your funds as she came to our office claiming that you are now incapacitated as a result of a ghastly motor accident you had some months ago? She further gave us and account details for the payment of the approved $1.6 million to be wired into her account. Kindly confirm this by getting back to us as soon as you can via my email below." Where to start with this? Mrs. Linda Chambers and I have a long and storied relationship. And she is not lying about the ghastly motor accident. The police report uses the word unseemly, but that's how the English police are. I don't know how many details Mrs. Linda Chambers shared with you, but I was riding my penny farthing, and as I am wont to do. And it's hard controlling a penny farthing because you have the tiny back wheel, which is about the size of a dime. And then you have the huge front wheel, which is the size of a tractor wheel. But I'm good. I can ride a penny farthing. So it's a very windy day, blustery, the English might call it. And I hadn't secured my ascot, and it was suddenly flapping around, and it adhered to my driving goggles. Next thing I know, I run over a street urchin. I don't remember doing that. I'm told that that's what I did. The last thing I remember was hearing a thud and saying, "Oh my." Linda and I, God, how do I put this into words? Linda and I attended boarding school in Essex. Back then, she was known as Lathy. Not Lady, Lathy. Back then, she was known as Lady Worthington, the Duchess of Lambeth. I did see that my account had a debit of $1.6 million, and I didn't give it a second thought. I should have. And so I can go to the police, but those of you that live outside of England, you know that the best way to settle it is to hire a guy who calls himself the governor and uses the phrase "in it" a lot. And so instead of contacting the police, I've contacted Guy Ritchie, and I'm currently interviewing men with Cockney accents. And I will let you know how that turns out. But if Mrs. Linda Chambers is listening, I bid you good day, young lady. You have not seen the last of me. I don't think that was long enough. This is from the Shame and Secrets survey, and this was filled out by a guy who calls himself Sam D. He identifies as bi-curious. He's in his 30s. Says that he was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. Wow, I would say it was a lot worse than that. He was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. He writes, I don't remember a lot of it. I know it happened when I was very young, at different times, by different people, from at least the ages of 3 to 8. I get weird, hazy flashbacks sometimes, but most of it is just noise and fog. When I was 17, part of this metal wall that I never knew existed cracked open and some stuff slipped out. I started having flashbacks and nightmares. I still have the nightmares, but they are less frequent. Though when I was 18, I jolted awake from one in a panic and tried to jump out of a two-story window, trying to escape whatever happened in my dream. I didn't go out it, though. My shoulder caught the window frame, and I smacked my face on the glass, and that woke me up fully. My now ex-wife freaked out because apparently I was screaming, though I don't recall screaming. He's been physically and emotionally abused. I've been emotionally abused by nearly every person that's ever been in my life. Parents, friends, significant others. As far as physical abuse, I've had a few instances with exes where they were ... a bit physical, but nothing severe. The worst thing, I would say, was when I lived as a slave on my uncle's farm for nearly a year. I slept on an old army cot with a tattered blanket and no pillow. I was allowed one meal a day, usually breakfast, provided I got my morning chores done in time for it. Wow. Any positive experiences with abusers? Yes, nearly every one of my abusers I have mixed feelings about, and it's so damn confusing and it messes my head up. That's one of the things that my therapist really helped me sort out, was holding two seemingly contradictory thoughts at the same time, because people oftentimes are walking contradictions. Darkest thoughts, taking bloody vengeance upon the people who have hurt me the absolute worst and broken me down to nothing but shattered pieces of the person I used to be. Darkest secrets. Sometimes I'm afraid I may continue the cycle of sexual abuse. I never have, but once in a while, a weird fantasy will float through my head, and it scares the hell out of me. I comfort myself by convincing myself that everyone is as fucked up as me, and we all just manage to hide and control the potential monsters that lurk within. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I love threesome fantasies, or just watching my significant other with someone else. Writing that makes me very uncomfortable to say to someone I have no intention of being intimate with. I'm not sure I understand that last part. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I want to ask my most recent ex of 5 years, why did you have to destroy me so thoroughly? Why didn't you just leave? Because I never got closure. And why would you like to say that? Because I never got closure. Just abused to the point I finally ran away. If not, it was going to get physical, because she started invoking my dead mother and trying to convince me my mom thought I was trash. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace. I just want some inner peace. I'm so tired of hurting, being miserable and alone. How do you feel after writing these things down? Uncomfortable and strange. Part of my mind feels like this is some sort of test I'm going to fail or something. Buddy, I really, really encourage you to find your tribe. They are out there. I know it's hard to hear when a track record with choosing people or being stuck with people when we were kids, when those experiences were not good, it's hard to believe that there's goodness in the world, but I really believe there is. This is from the love survey filled out by Kim, and she writes, I love swimming in a deep pool. I don't think we've had that one before, and it's such a simple one, but oh, I love when like the deep end of a pool is like 10 or 12 feet deep. I don't know, why is that? I love making the green light on a left turn that I can take in third gear. Third gear, that's a pretty high gear to make a left-hand turn. Like, that of all the shit I ponder deeply on the podcast, that one just absorbs me the most. Third gear. I think you need to find a support group around shifting. I love this one. Sitting on a tailgate, swinging my feet. And I love when my dog lays on top of me during a panic attack. I wonder if your dog senses that, or are you calling your dog over to lay on you? But yeah, I love when I get into bed at night and Gracie comes running into the bedroom and she just lays across me with her face right next to mine. And it's just like, it's like a sleeping pill. This is from the Shame and Secret survey, and this is filled out by an agender person who calls themselves Emissary of the Birdmen. They identify as pansexual. They're in their 20s, say that they were raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. They were the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. When I was 8 and my brother was 10, he asked me to touch his dick when we were camping in the backyard. I gave it a poke. I confronted him about this as an adult, and he says he doesn't remember, but it's really disturbing that he did that. I believe him, and I'm not mad at him because I also touched other kids when I was a kid, and I know kids don't really understand how wrong it is. Also, my mom would walk around the house naked the whole time we were growing up. I think that could have been okay if we as a family were more neutral about bodies, but she was very strict about making sure I covered up enough and constantly told me about how predatory men were. One time, my brother and I were brushing our teeth in the bathroom. He was 15 and I was 13, and she was giving herself a sponge bath completely naked. My brother asked her to stop, and she laughed and said, I'm torturing you with my naked body. Wow, that is so sadistic. And people, if you hear me say that and you're like, well, that sounds like an exaggeration, it's not. It's not. It's not. I don't think she saw this as abuse, since she seemed to think only men could do it. It was incredibly cruel, and I think her doing this was an assertion of power. I completely agree. When I was 12 to 13, a group of younger boys started chasing me around the playground, trying to touch me sexually and saying awful sexual things to me. It went on for months. I told teachers, and when they did nothing, I fought back physically, which I was then disciplined for. I felt like a monster for using violence against them because they were younger and I was big for my age. But I was in this horrible double bind, being told by the adults who were supposed to protect me that I was, quote, egging them on, unquote. God, that is so fucked up. I felt like they wanted me just to let it happen or not to exist at all. I had a couple of degrading sexual experiences as an 18 to 19-year-old, or being pressured to have sex or seeking out sex as a form of self-harm, but for brevity, I won't go into them. Then, when I was 20, I was in this year-long relationship with a much older narcissist who convinced me I was sexually broken and that he was the only one who would put up with me. Told me if I wasn't going to fuck him, I couldn't stay at his house. Tried to threaten to cheat on me if I didn't fuck him, which didn't work because we were in an open relationship. Over and over again, he would dump me because I wasn't giving him enough sex, and we had a lot of sex, and then pretended it never happened. It was the worst experience of my life. After I finally got rid of him, I told my mom what happened, and she got mad at me. To this day, I don't know if she didn't believe me or didn't care, and to this day, I don't know which is worse. That hurt more than the actual abuse, but it made me realize that I'd been lying to myself. The lie was that my mom was hard on me because she loved me and wanted to keep me safe. But she didn't love me. There was nothing there. That sounds pretty accurate to me. They've been emotionally abused. The emotional abuse came from my mom, who is a real piece of work, as you can imagine. Someone I dated at 18, the narcissist, obviously. The chef at a vegan restaurant I worked in. A girl I was dating slash sleeping with on and off again for years, and several roommates who all ganged up on me during the pandemic, though it was going on for a year or so before that. Just a lot of garbage. I'm not going to unpack all of it. Any positive experiences with abusers? Definitely. I'm nostalgic for all the baking and gardening I did with my mom as a kid. I had some fun with a narcissist, since that was my hippie year, where I went to a lot of festivals and took a lot of psychedelics, though he usually ruined it. The girl I miss a lot because we had all the same hobbies and interests and had great conversations, and we would get high and sit on the floor of her attic apartment in the summer heat, listening to Bright Eyes or Montreal, and making ceramic art or doing stick and poke tattoos on each other. We also had great sex. Whenever I look at the tattoos she did or listen to certain Bright Eyes songs, I miss her, but I know she wasn't good for me. Darkest thoughts. I sometimes get solipsistic and start thinking I'm God. Darkest secrets. I touched my cousin when I was 12 and he was a toddler. I was frantically suicidal with guilt about it for years and years, but now I understand that there are no good or bad people, only good or bad actions, and all I can do is choose to be kind now. I haven't talked to him about it because he may not remember, and I don't want to stir it up. His peace is more important than mine. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you? My fantasies are almost always about sexually dominating and physically overpowering others. I fantasize about living in different eras of history where I'm in a position of power and I have wives and or concubines, both male and female. I'm usually male in these fantasies, though I'm physically female, but not always. People are tied up a lot of the time. It's a little embarrassing, but also comical to admit this for some reason. I feel the need to specify that in reality, I only want to dominate people who want to submit or be overpowered. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? To my mom, drop the act. I know you don't love me. I've known for years. What, if anything, do you wish for? The opportunity to help animals and queer teenagers. And in parentheses, weird combination, I know, but they're the two categories I feel the most compassion towards. Have you shared these things with others? Yes. The responses were varied, but mostly empathetic. How do you feel after writing these things down? Satisfied with the narrative I've laid out, but guilty for putting off the PowerPoint I'm supposed to be working on. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Fuck, man, it's bad out there. You can't control how other people treat you. I hope you find somewhere safe. Thank you for that. You went deep. And I just want to congratulate you on getting honest with yourself about your relationship with your mom. Because the insanity of going to a dry well for water, especially with a parent or a family member or a partner, is so degrading to our lives and our sanity. And it's amazing how the lengths we will go to avoid the truth, the painful truth that somebody doesn't know how to love us, or something's not healthy for us, something we're doing to ourselves. But it's so freeing when we surrender to that, kind of like the woman I was talking about in the beginning of the podcast, the woman trapped with nowhere to go, just spinning her tires. I mean, what a metaphor. Metaphor? Analogy? I don't know. Go fuck yourself. I don't even know who I was telling, go fuck yourself. Was I telling the people that... I think I was telling the people who thought to themselves, old man, you should know the difference between a metaphor and an analogy. I believe a metaphor is just like an inanimate thing, whereas an analogy can be something that involves action or more than one object. Oh, I feel so stupid. Why didn't I just keep my mouth shut? And finally, this is a happy moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Footy Player. And he writes, I spent most of my 20s with a wonderful woman. We'd been having a rough time for a couple of years, but both loved each other. Something just wasn't clicking. We took a vacation and shit hit the fan. It ended with us deciding to split up. I felt paralyzed and helpless. We were living together for almost 6 months after the breakup to see out our lease, and during that time, we naturally started to distance from one another, but continued to behave like a couple in some ways, cooking each other dinner, sleeping in the same bed, acting like a couple in front of our friends. There wasn't really any room to process this situation, even though things were becoming more bitter and confrontational. One night, we decided to play Bananagrams and had a wonderful time. From then on, we played probably 5 times per week and had so much fun. It felt like when we first started dating and had no baggage. A couple of times we even caught each other's eye and saw that spark. It was our way to enjoy each other and show our love, even though we knew the end was nigh. Years after, I still think about the fun we had playing Bananagrams, and it makes me happy, even though the hurt is still there. I miss her and think I always will. I love that. I love that. And I have no idea what Bananagrams is. But it sounds like a very powerful game. And I don't mean that sarcastically. Thank you for that. And thank you everyone who filled out surveys, people who support us on Patreon. I'm not going to do my Patreon spiel. I'm just kind of burned out with that. But yeah, I just want to say it's important to have compassion for others, but not at the expense of compassion for yourself. That has been one of the most important guiding tenets in me having any kind of peace in my life. If you're out there and you're feeling stuck, just never forget that you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.